Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on strategic relocation when we come back. You know, in 1970, the world food supply was 73 days for every man, woman, and child in the world. But today, it's down to less than 38 days. Now, we Americans produce grain for export, and then we buy our grapes from Chile, Mexico, and berries from Guatemala. Our food supply is in the hands of foreigners and multinational corporations now who support this global 2000 population reduction program. And all of this globalization may be good for business, but globalization isn't good for you and it's not good for me. Back in 1940, all of us had a pantry full of food to feed our families for a year or more. Today, we have a 3-day supply in our refrigerators, and we believe fervently in our supermarket system of just-in-time delivery to feed us all forever. But over the past 60 years, we've traded a 1-year food supply in our own possession for a 3-day supply and a lick and a promise for the future. And these global 2000 mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians plan to use famine, along with plague, disease, and pestilence, to reduce Earth's population by 90% over the next 50 years, or so says the Club of Rome. And these evil madmen with their global 2000 genocide agenda have a cause that they're willing to die for. And I say let them die for their cause, but let's you and I live for ours. Let me show you from the scripture how to be a live survivor instead of a dead victim. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Keep in mind that it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email machine and send an email request for your free General Law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Strategic Relocation, a book written by Joel Skousen. Joel Skousen is an ex-Marine pilot, goes back to the Vietnam era, a businessman. His business is in putting together these retreats for the elite. And I thought that was a unique, unusual business. People who have money want to make sure that they're taken care of in the event of their being a Hurricane Katrina, or there being a nuclear bomb war, or there being a war or some other kind of a problem that may affect them, such as the drug cartels and kidnapping and things like that. People with money take care of themselves. But he wrote the book from the point of view of what does a truck driver, a housewife, or a waitress, or a blue-collar worker who lives in a mega metropolitan area like Los Angeles or Seattle or maybe New York or Philadelphia. What do we do? Is there a plan for us? Is there a plan that we can afford to put into play? And the answer to that is yes. And that's why I thought I would report strategic relocation. Now, have you ever had a conversation with a buddy or a friend, and you're sitting there having coffee over at Starbucks, and maybe you're talking about war? Well, if war ever came to this country, Or if we had a hurricane like Hurricane Katrina, here's what I would do. I can remember a time or two when, you know, people get to talking, well, I'll pack all the family into the suburban and we'll just go back up into the mountains and we'll just live off the land. We'll just shoot deer and we'll just live out of the back of our suburban, and I've got tents and camping gear, and boy, I can just take care of us. I remember when I was a youngster and I had young children, we'd go camping once in a while. You know, you pack everybody in the car, the trailer, the camper, whatever you got, and you go out and you kind of rough it in the mountains, you know, for 3 days or over a weekend or maybe a week. I've done that a time or two. Boy, that's uncomfortable, isn't it? I mean, you know, you're out here and it's the summertime and there's no air conditioning, and it's hot and nasty, and you want to take a shower, and if you want to take a shower, you got to take a bath in a cold creek, and then the mosquitoes are packing you around, deciding whether they want to eat you down at the creek or up on the side of the hill. And we call that fun. We do that, you know, for a week, and we tough it out. How would you like to do that for a year or two or three, day in and day out? You know, the people will say, well, we're going to live off the land. I'll just shoot deer because I'm a hunter. Excuse me, but when you've got, for instance, in our county, 10,000 people and 18,000 deer, and a deer has about 30 or 40 pounds of meat on him, and when you get him all butchered out and you got 30 pounds of meat and you're eating about a pound a day and you got five people in the family, that's about a six-day supply. That means that you need about 52 deer per year. You ever do the arithmetic on that? Because during the Depression years, back in the 1930s, here in Ozark County, Missouri, the people lived off the land. And when they got all through in 1940, the government took a census of deer and they counted 142 survivors. They counted them. 142 deer in the county. Now, today, I'm happy to report that they tell us there's 18,000 deer in the county. So that means that everybody in the county has about two deer, or about 60 pounds of meat. And that doesn't count all you people who might be coming through here from the major metropolitan areas, shooting and killing what you can. They wiped out the turkeys. There weren't very many possums or coons or skunks or anything else that was left in the county, and certainly the deer population was near extinct. Now, can you picture that again? And then say, well, I'll just live out of the back of my car or my van or my SUV with my tent, living off the land. The practicalities of that is simply that it's preposterous on its face. Just nonsense. That isn't going to fly. That isn't going to work. That isn't going to happen. Not in the real world. The same thing just happened, and we all got to see what happens when a major disaster hits a major metropolitan area. New Orleans is the 23rd largest city, or it was 23rd largest city in the nation, wiped out suddenly. Now, take a look at the problems that all of those people who lived there faced immediately after the event, and are still going through, going on to 2 years later. So, if you want to do that, you know, get after it. But if you'd like to think about what would I do if I was in that same position, how would I solve that problem, or what could I do differently that would be of help? Now, a lot of times people will talk about, I'm going to go to the Hawaiian Islands, or I would go down to the Caribbean Islands. I would go down to the Turks and Caicos or Aruba or someplace and hide out on those islands down there, which there are a lot of them. Here's what Skousen has as an observation concerning islands like Hawaii or Puerto Rico and the islands of the Caribbean. He said, I do not usually recommend Hawaii, Puerto Rico, or any of the Caribbean islands as retreats unless you're an experienced seaman and have your own boat. Under this last condition, you can overcome the major objection to island living, and that the fact that you're trapped by the surrounding water. In addition, on most islands, food growing potential is limited in comparison with the available land and the high density of population. Hardly any islands are self-sufficient. and prices for imported supplies are high, and they can be cut off quickly by shipping or labor strikes, or by the government for whatever reason. However, if you have a long-distance sailing vessel or a motor yacht, you have a way off the islands without being held hostage by commercial transportation or by your government. In order to make this strategy work, you must have pre-positioned stockpiles for your boat, including fuel, before any crisis develops. And you should regularly take to the open seas to test your equipment from time to time. There are many excellent books on the subject, so I'm not going to go into any details here, except to mention one specific tactic. Your greatest vulnerability on the open seas is the growing threat of being commandeered by pirates or halted by government entities which may attempt to control the sea where you're located. And almost no sailing vessels or motor yachts can outrun these larger vessels, so you may want to consider carrying one of the new lightweight mini speedboats aboard your ship, which can be lowered into the water quickly and then give you a means to maneuver and escape. And also, never go on the open seas for any extended voyage without some defensive weapons. And also make sure that no one ever enters your craft with any type of recreational drugs, because even the smallest residue of these illegal drugs is an open invitation for some overzealous Coast Guard official to confiscate your boat. Now, there's some practical advice concerning, well, I think I'll just go down to Puerto Rico, or I'll go down to some island in the Caribbean, or out to Hawaii. Now, we here at the law school also have some objections to the islands, and let me share with you just as an aside. I have been over to Hawaii, and we have students that live there. And I happened to have a Hawaiian student some years back, and he invited me over to his house. His wife was Miss Hawaii of 1958. Imagine she's, you know, for most of you people, that's kind of elderly. But, you know, these are pretty well-placed people. This fellow here happened to be a descendant of the Queen of Hawaii, who was overthrown back in 1892 during the Grover Cleveland administration. That's when America took over the Hawaiian Islands. So he's pretty familiar with the local politics and the local thinking among the Hawaiian people as it relates to the whites and the Japanese and the other intruders that have come to the Hawaiian Islands over the years. And he pointed out to me that the Hawaiians hate the whites. And, you know, for pretty good reason. I mean, after all, we went over there and stole their islands, overthrew their monarchy, and subjugated them to American domination. Now, for that, they don't hold us in the great and high esteem that, you know, most white Anglo-Saxons think that they ought to. After all, we saved them from a monarchy, didn't we? And we gave them democracy, as if democracy were the cure-all to all political strife. So he pointed out to me that if there was ever a breakdown in civil authority or order in the Hawaiian Islands, that there will be no white men left alive on those islands. He said, the Japanese also have a beef with the whites, and that is that most of the Orientals that are in the islands are Japanese, and we're the folks that brought the atomic bombs and the atomic age to Japan, and that those people practice ancestor worship, and they cannot rest until they have been avenged. Now, I don't know about the local religions and the local politics of the Japanese and the native Hawaiian Islanders. I'm just reporting to you what was reported to me by a very high and well-placed native Hawaiian, a purebred, whole Hawaiian, who said, if we ever get the opportunity, there will be no whites left alive in these islands. So I pass that on for your consideration, because a lot of people especially whites, believe that going to the Hawaiian Islands is just the cure-all to all political and social strife. And while there's peace and prosperity in the world, Hawaii's a heck of a nice place to go to vacation and then leave and come back home. If you are thinking about subsistence and survival in the Hawaiian Islands, make sure that you're Japanese or Hawaiian. Now, he goes on to point out that there are some safe rural counties. And then on page 221, he points out that based on the census data amassed during the 1990 through the 1999, or 95 period rather, I have compiled a listing of every county in every state of the United States with some essential data that will allow you to assess any county's potential for safety and stability. In the first printing of this book, I listed only those counties which met certain minimum standards in incidence of crime, population density, and conservative political leanings. However, I was constantly getting phone calls asking why certain counties, almost indistinguishable from those listed, were not included. And in almost all cases, they were also safe, but just over one of the set cutoff standards. And so, in this next printing, I'm going to give you the data on all of the counties. Then you can check them against my criteria and then make your own judgment. But keep in mind that even unsafe counties, judged by the overall criteria, can still have some safe areas tucked away in their rural areas away from the problematic cities. The three prime indicators for medium-term stability are low population density, that's number one, a low incidence of criminal activity, that's number two, and conservative political demographics. Now remember, long-term safety is not really a matter of local threats, but those of national or international scope, such as war, tyranny, large-scale natural disasters. But for the present, you can find relative peace and safety in most rural areas of the United States and Canada. So in the following 90 pages, I've listed all of the counties in the United States in terms of the following factors. First of all, the population density. Ideally, you will be looking for county population densities of less than 150 people per square mile. But in reality, most rural population densities are down to 10 to 35 people per square mile. But the presence of any moderate-sized city in your county will skew this number and make the whole county look more dense than it really is. The ideal counties have overall densities no greater than 150 to 300 people per square mile. And what this equates to is one or two small cities which have the benefit of giving you access to goods and services without compromising farmland. The second thing that we're looking for is minority population percentages. As discussed earlier in the book, minorities are not a problem in and of themselves. As with any population group, it depends upon the actual quality of the individuals who are involved. But even though there are black and Hispanic areas which run counter to the normal trend of high crime and high welfare participation, most minority areas have higher than average incidence of crime and a higher than average demand for social benefits. Avoid those counties where this correlation exists, not for reasons of racial prejudice, but for reasons of safety. And third, the crime data per 100,000 persons. Now, the first figure is minor crime, such as theft and robbery. But the second is violent crime, such as murder, rape, and assault. Now, these figures are never totally accurate, however, and that's because many police departments underreport the actual violent crimes going on in their jurisdictions for political purposes. But crime numbers are significant when the numbers are high. So let's note the general correlation with high population densities, and then look for counties with less than 5,000 crimes per 100,000 population. And then when we look at violent crimes, we're looking for an area that has less than 500 violent crimes per year per 100,000 violation. And then fourth, the political demographics. So I list the percentage of registered Democrats, Republicans, and Independents voting for Ross Perot in the 1992 and 1996 elections. And I considered a county a poor bet for long-term political stability if the percentage of liberals or Democratic voters is over 45%. And there's a direct correlation between welfareism and the resentment of the free market among these voters. High numbers of Republicans certainly is no guarantee of liberty, as we can see with President Bush and the Republicans in power today. But it shows a general rejection of government intrusion into the lives of individuals, the more conservative the political demographics of an area are. So remember, most of the problem data in these county charts are associated with large cities. And you can find relatively safe sites even in these counties, but you must stay clear of mass exit routes from the cities. So select trees to give you seclusion. View sites are okay as long as the view is rural and the house is not visible from the main roads. I liked that little section in there. In our subsistence and survival school here at the law school, we follow that same general rule or that same general format. However, I noticed here this is a very detailed demographic plan for every county in the United States. Let me give you a couple of three examples. Naturally, since I live in Ozark County, Missouri, I'm kind of interested in my county. So I wanted to know, well, how did he rate Ozark County? Because I have a rating for my county or my area, and that's because I live here. And I took a look here at Missouri, and they're in alphabetical order. In our state, we have 113 counties, and so I noticed here in alphabetical order, Ozark County, Missouri has a population density of 12 people per square mile. So that fits in with the population density program. Minorities, we have 0, 0, 0. Then when we come to crime per 100,000, notice that he was looking for no more than 5,000 crimes per 100,000. We're down at 1,000 crimes, only 20% of the maximum. Violent crime is 126. 500, remember, is the cutoff limit. The percentage of poor that we have in our county is 1.8%. And the number of Democrats in the county is 37%. Everybody else is either a Republican or an Independent. So in our county, where our demographics politically are about 70% conservative or moderate, as opposed to liberal or liberal Democrat. And we don't have a very big minority problem. In fact, we have none at all, and we don't have much in the way of poverty here. So there's not very many poor people, not very many liberals. We have a low population density, only 12 people per square mile, and it fits all of the demographic and political criteria that he sets down. And wherever you live in the United States, these 92 pages that he's included has your county with these same demographics. I thought that was a dynamite idea. Well, let me write that one off here. I'll circle off number 21 there, and let's take a look at another page called the Ozarks, page 216. On page 216, the general area of the Ozarks Plateau is discussed, along with a map on page 215, which has little areas with letters like A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and it goes up to J, K, L. And it covers the Mason-Dixon line, southern Missouri, northern Arkansas, Tennessee, North Carolina, and all the way down to Florida, goes over to Texas. So we've got Texas, Oklahoma, over to the Atlantic seaboard, including Florida. In looking at Florida, there isn't any safe place that he has marked in Florida. In 23 years, my observation was exactly the same. I couldn't see any place in Florida or southern Mississippi, Alabama, or Georgia that I would want to locate in. There is a small area in the three-state area, actually there's four states here, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Tennessee in the Appalachian Mountains that I observed years ago looked like a pretty good subsistence and survival location, and I note here that he has that labeled as K. It's area K, and he's got that area zeroed out. When we get over here to the Ozarks, let's take a look on page 216, and here's what he says. The Ozarks of Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Missouri. This is one of the best retreat areas in the nation, with beautiful forests, abundant game animals, clear rivers, and a good mix of pine, oak, and other trees. Its only drawback is that its fine reputation for privacy and beauty has attracted a few radical groups which have established small communal compounds. None of these people would represent a problem were it not that their groups have been infiltrated with government agents who are constantly attempting to provoke these survivalist-type people into some rash act for which they can be hunted down and prosecuted. And it's for this reason that I never recommend that you join with any formal groups in establishing common living territory. Stay connected with society and separate yourself at the same time. I couldn't have said it any more coherently or intelligently or succinctly, I guess I should say, other than that. Have you ever thought about and have you heard about these various survival compounds and groups that people want to associate themselves with? And they become, and we had one here not too far away from where I'm speaking right now, which was infiltrated by the government. And then they provoked these people to a confrontation, then had this big standoff. And then they arrested these people, locked them up, and sent them off to prison. Who wants to be associated with a bunch of radicals and kooks? And you can figure out for yourself, you know, where you ought to live or where you want to live and how you want to live without trying to associate yourself with what we term here as the groupies. Groupies. And the groupies are kind of a natural phenomenon that we see in human beings. People like to associate like birds of a feather flocked together. But for what we're coming up to in the Great Tribulation, I don't think that flocking together like birds of a feather is very wise, and neither did Skousen. And he's got some pretty good and some pretty succinct reasons as to why not. Now, the Ozarks, he rates as A-. We rate it as A+, not seeing that there's any problem at all with these other conservative groups, but he didn't quite like those conservative groups that are here in the Ozarks, and so he rated it as an A-. I'm not going to get into the specifics of Area D or Area C or Louisiana or East Texas or Alabama, etc. But what I wanted to report was that he has a very detailed and comprehensive analysis of each of these areas in each state. For instance, just as a point here in South Carolina, just where that chick's beak is, just a few hundred square miles, if there's that much, is all the area of South Carolina that's worth looking at. And just the mountainous area between Tennessee and North Carolina. So he's taken a lot of time, effort, and energy to put the maps together and show you with specificity the areas that you should consider in relocation. And the rest of it is probably where you already live, in some major metropolitan area like New Orleans or like Los Angeles, where when riots and social unrest and upheavals take place, now what are you going to do? Or if there is a nuclear bomb war and your city gets nuked like Omaha, Nebraska, what do you do next? When you take a look at what happened in New Orleans, just extrapolate that into your city and then ask yourself, what do I do to avoid that? Now, he's got a little story in here on people that live in the major cities. And so he has what he calls a Plan A, Plan B, and Plan C. It's what he calls putting it all together. And he's got quite a little section here on putting it all together. Many people do not want to leave the city. They don't want to leave Los Angeles or New York, because that's where their businesses are located, their professions. That's where the money's, at. So Plan A is you live in the city and you prepare or plan for an exit from the city to a safe place. The safe place has to be within one tank of gas from where you are in the city to where you need to go. And then a Plan C. If you can get one tank of gas away from the city, which isn't going to be a long-term safety place, then you have to leapfrog to the next spot, which is Plan C. I thought that that made all the sense in the world. Plan A, Plan B, and Plan C. I mean, if you can't live out here in the country and you have to live in the city because that's where you make your living, don't you think that you ought to have a place to go when a hurricane like Katrina hits New Orleans? Or put another way, if everybody in New Orleans had a Plan B, a place to go to, and when the hurricane was approaching and everybody had left and gone to their place of safety, then there wouldn't have been anybody killed, would there? And the property damage would be the same. But what if the people of New Orleans had planned on a Hurricane Katrina and figured that a Class 5 hurricane was coming and built the levees and built their residences and built their city as if they were really serious about a potential hurricane? What if the people on the Gulf Coast had planned for and built as if they were expecting a tidal surge and expecting that there would be a Class 5 hurricane? You think there'd be as much property damage? Do you think there'd be as many people killed? Do you think there'd be as much problem? The thing that I always thought was so interesting as an aftermath of this is that the government came in and said, we're going to spend $500 billion of your people's money up in Seattle and Tacoma and Los Angeles and Philadelphia to rebuild these places right here on this same Gulf Coast, right here in this same city, as if this was the first, last, and only hurricane that's ever going to strike that coast. Now, I don't mind people building their houses on the ocean. I just mind being saddled with the bill of rebuilding their house every time it gets blown down. I kind of figure that I live in Tornado Alley, and I live here by choice. And if a tornado knocks my house down, it's not your responsibility to rebuild my house because of my bad choice. Guess that's just me. And let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling site or the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. However, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions, however, that you do hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers or the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, now that we've taken care of the FCC and all of the government bureaucrats, and we hope we've satisfied everybody there, let me tell you that this book, Strategic Relocation, is a product put out by a fellow named Joel M. Skousen. I don't know if this book is in print or if you can get it or not. It was put in my hands, and I thought I'd share it with you, because if you could get a copy by hook or by crook or in any way, or you can ask around and see, you know, if there's anybody that's got one, it's sure worthwhile, in my view. The guy's name is Joel M. Skousen, published it in 1998. And you can contact the author, it says here on the title page, at 290 West, 580 South, Orem, Utah, 84058. Again, that's 290 West, 580 South, Orem, Utah, 84058. Now, they've got a phone number there. Phone number is 801-224-4746. Again, that's 801-224-4746. And they've also got an email, or at least they did, and it's jskousen, jskousen@enol.com. They've also got a publisher, Swift Learning Resources, American Fork, Utah. That publisher, again, is Swift Learning Resources, American Fork, Utah. The number to call, 1-800-292 1-800-292-2831. Again, that's 1-800-292-2831. Oftentimes, if the author has moved and he's no longer available and the book's out of print, you might go to the Swift Learning Resources. Hell, they might have 10 or 15 cases of book back in the warehouse, or books, you know, back in the warehouse somewhere that they didn't sell. And there might be a copy or two that they might sell you. Got no idea what the price is, but if it's $100 or less, it's a steal. If you paid $100 for the 300 pages that are in here, you'd be paying about 33 cents a page. And I didn't see a page in here that wasn't worth 33 cents. So, again, you know, the price and value is in the eye of the beholder. It's the information that you want, not the comparisons. I know a lot of times people say, oh my God, $30? Why, it's only a paperback. Boys and girls, you ain't paying the 30 bucks because it's hardbound or paperback. You're paying 30 bucks for the information that's contained. And this guy's got a bunch of information. Let me give you a couple of reminders here also. Our health class, February 5th through the 9th. Let me give you a couple of pointers here. We're offering a new class on health and healing, which covers the alternative healing methods being used for treatment and healing of such things as cancer and other degenerative diseases, which now affect about half of Americans, or will affect half of us in our lifetime, and how to prevent these degenerative diseases, and the use of application of essential oils. Now remember, there's 32 of these essential oils mentioned in the scripture. Super nutritional foods containing more nutrients and fewer calories. And the class also includes hands-on teaching, paperwork, allergic reaction testing and training, so you can do it at home, acupressure application and training, so you can find your pressure points. And there's much, much more to contribute to your overall ongoing health. Class is taught by my wife, who is a 28-year cancer survivor. She's been using alternative therapy for 28 years. She practices what she preaches, and she's pretty good at it. And the average lifespan is, they say you're cured of cancer, you know, if you live 5 years. If you die at 6, 7, or 8, that's too bad. Now, my wife's lived for 28, so I would contend that she knows a little something about what she's talking about. And then Austin, Texas, February the 26th through March the 2nd, we'll be down there, at least we plan to teach a tax school. And if you've got things cleaned up down there by then, Austin, Texas, February the 26th through March 2nd. All right, we're talking about Joel M. Skousen's, or Joel M., yeah, Joel M. Skousen's book. He's got a section in here called The Threat Analysis. He's got a lot to say in here about the potential threats that we all face. For instance, he makes an observation here talking about nuclear forces. And he said, as a result of the START II treaty, the U.S. Department of Defense prepared a nuclear policy review issued on September the 22nd, 1994, which projected U.S. nuclear forces in the year 2003 after the treaty provisions go into effect. The current plans are to have 3,500 strategic warheads, 950 non-strategic warheads, and 550 spares counted as part of the active inventory. The Space Command handles all of the special sensors around the world that track missiles and satellites, and these are the eyes of the defensive forces and are prime targets for any nation wishing to blind our ability to detect missile launches and to deter satellite data transfer. And these organizations and locations are as follows. And so he lists a bunch of Air Force bases, like Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. They have phased array radar. And then there's Robins Air Force Base in Georgia, and Beale Air Force Base in California, Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and Clear, Alaska Defense Radar, and so on. I'm not going to bore you with all these various places, but as an ex-military man and as an ex-Marine pilot, I suppose that he was privy to, and I don't think that there's anything top secret about the information here, or he wouldn't be publishing it. But If you're living nearby one of these Air Force bases, it's a prime target. And his point is, you know, you can avoid a whole lot more problems than you can get yourself out of. I kind of liken that in our subsistence and survival school to earthquake protection in San Francisco, California. If you were to leave San Francisco, California and relocate to another region of the country, such as Ozark County, Missouri, of the 64 life-threatening problems described in the Bible, of which earthquakes are one of them, you can practically eliminate earthquakes from your problem list by simply leaving the area. And somebody's going to write me a letter and say, yeah, you're going to move out from the earthquakes and move into the tornadoes. Well, that's true. And weather upsets are certainly a part of Bible prophecy. And tornadoes are certainly a curse. There's nothing that I can see that's good about a tornado hitting the ground and tearing everybody's houses down, ripping through the trailer parks. But there's a trade-off that comes from these strategic moves that you make. Decisions that you make today in 2007 are going to impact upon you over the next 10, 15, 20 years. It'll impact upon you economically. It may impact upon you physically. It may have other impacts that we can't foresee today that may occur down the line, a year, 5 years, 10 years from now. Like, what if I had moved from Boise, Idaho to New Orleans, Louisiana in, say, 1985? Well, by 2005, where would I have been living in New Orleans? Would my house have been destroyed? That's a decision that I had to make in 1985, and I made it, and I didn't move to New Orleans, and so I'm very glad that I did not. I didn't move to Omaha, Nebraska either, and that's because Omaha, Nebraska has some problems associated with it that I didn't want to get involved in. Well, Mr. Skousen goes through literally dozens of places. In fact, there are 150 major metropolitan areas in North America, ranging from Mexico City, Mexico to Montreal, Canada, and all parts in between. And he has a little something to say about every region, about every city, major metropolitan area, and what the basic problems are and what the targeting is all about. For instance, these are prime targets and secondary targets. A secondary target is a place like St. Louis, Missouri. It could be bombed. It's a big city. But it's not likely to be bombed because there's not much there of strategic value for the Russians or Chinese or some potential enemy. Now, remember, what Skousen is talking about here isn't a terror attack like we saw on 9/11 that killed 3,000 people. He's talking about a terror attack that's going to kill 300,000 or 3 million people, maybe 30 million people. And what do you do to defend or protect yourself against that? So he brings up the subject of Omaha, Nebraska, and he points out that the Strategic Air Command, SAC, the Strategic Air Command, is located there in Omaha, Nebraska. He points out that Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado is in very close proximity to Colorado Springs. So in his analysis, he says Colorado Springs is a bad place to be, and Omaha, Nebraska is a bad place to be. And if you're in that location, it would make more sense for you to be thinking about moving away from there, moving your business, moving your occupation, moving your family, away from a prime target area. And we're just talking now about the potential for nuclear attack or nuclear bomb war, which, by the way, is guaranteed by Ezekiel 5 and Ezekiel 6. There's another indication that we're facing nuclear bomb war in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. And I would say that there is a second to that proposal in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy chapter 28. But with specificity, Ezekiel says we're going to get nuked. So I just thought I'd share that with you. Unfortunately, Ezekiel didn't tell us which cities are going to get nuked or which locations. And it would occur to me, just as a bystander, just as a reporter, that in all probability, these sites that are picked out by this guy Skousen are probably pretty prime targets, because there have been a lot of people write a lot of books on this subject of nuclear attack. So he points out with some specificity which areas that you need to avoid. And if you can't, and if you have to be there, can you locate yourself as far away from the Air Force base near Omaha as possible? If you have to live in or around Colorado Springs, can you locate yourself as far from Cheyenne Mountain as possible? And then you face another prospect or another possibility that you may have to have a bomb shelter located in your Plan A program that will withstand the blast, which is might be 5 or 10 miles away from you. Now, if you think you want to live 5 or 10 miles away from a nuclear blast, you ought to prepare for that. If you think you want to live on the Gulf Coast, on the beach, then you ought to prepare for a Class 5 hurricane. I took a look at that and I said, you know, I think I'll stay away from the Gulf Coast. I think I'll stay away from Omaha, Nebraska. I think I'll avoid that problem of a big earthquake in San Francisco, California by not living there. But, you know, millions of people live in these major metropolitan areas, and that's where they make their living. So if you're one of those and you can't leave, then you need to be thinking about, well, what am I going to do, or what would my reaction be, or what plans can I make? I want to share with you here, because most people believe that in a nuclear attack, there is no hope. Well, that's probably true if you have no preparations. People with no preparations, I would concede, have very little, if any, hope. But you need to understand that people like the Skousen actually put together survival programs for people who live in downtown San Diego, Omaha, and Colorado Springs. People who are willing to spend the money to live through a potential blast 5 or 10 miles from ground zero and walk away from it. And when I read that in his book, I was really amazed, because, you know, an old farm kid like me, you know, when we think about nuclear bomb war, we think about, my God, how far away can I get from Omaha, Nebraska? No, sir. There's people like President Bush living in the White House with Washington, D.C., a prime target. And they, honest to God, believe that they can save most of the cabinet, the president, and most of the members of Congress in the underground bunkers and blast shelters that they have constructed under the Capitol, under the White House, and in other areas. As soon as the coast is clear, they're going to leave Washington and operate from their underground facilities in Camp David and other secret locations that we don't know about. As I reported to you in the last program or in this series, that Frontline put on an expose and said, now, the president and the Congress and congressional members and the cabinet and certain governors and legislators are slated to survive nuclear war. And I said, you know, if these people, the elites, you know, the called out and chosen ones of our society, can survive it, then why can't we? Now, I'm going to share one more little thing. It's not necessarily in Skousen's book, or at least I didn't see it here, but I got another book here that I've been using for quite a few years that deals with this problem of nuclear fallout. Do you know that your home, just your house, can be turned into a fallout shelter if you knew how to do that? That's right. You can seal your house and you can put in a relatively inexpensive air filter system into your own home. And so when the fallout comes, you can hole up in your home, keep the fallout out of your house, and survive it. And I thought, you know, that's really surprising because until I got the information and researched out, I kind of thought that if you were living downwind from Seattle, you know, you might as well put your head between your knees and kiss her goodbye. Come to find out that the farther you are away from the blast area, the better. But even if you're relatively close by and you're getting bombarded by a Chernobyl-type fallout, that there is a methodology whereby you could survive that in your own home if you could prepare it. I got a videotape here not too long ago, and they pointed that out, and they said, now here's the way you do that. And, of course, one of the things you need is a Geiger counter, one of these radiation detectors, they call them now. I used to call them Geiger counters when I was a kid. But they now call them radiation detectors, and I got one. And I sent it off and bought one. Cost $135. And I'm pretty well prepared. I've got duct tape and I've got plastic, and I'm a long ways away from any potential blast area. But you know, I'm ready, just in case. And heck, what happens if nobody bombs Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Little Rock, or Kansas City, or St. Louis? So what? So what? I'm kind of like red green. I have the handyman secret weapon. I have duct tape and lots of it. I can seal up my house, or I can use it for other things as the years go by. It's fairly cheap and inexpensive. I didn't have to go out here and hire a contractor and spend $30,000 building a fallout shelter. And I can make do with what I've got, and I can probably survive it. And if I don't, at least I can give it a hell of a good go, as they would say in England. We can give it a good go. But you know, you can too. And so if you're living in Austin, Texas, or Philadelphia, Miami, or some other place that you think might get blasted, or you might live downwind from a blast area, if you just knew the simple tricks to securing your own home in your own neighborhood, in your own big city, you know, you might be one of the few survivors that can survive the fallout when it occurs. Well, if it occurs. Let me give you a reminder that we are analyzing, or we are reporting on the book called Strategic Relocation, North American Guide to Safe Places. It covers Canada, the United States, and Mexico. So if you're living in Mexico and you say, well, do we need something like this? Yeah, you might have some fallout problems that come from the United States, or you might have an influx of gringos coming across the border. This book is available, or we think it might be available, from Swift Learning Resources, American Fork, Utah. Contact them at 1-800-292-2831, or you could call the author, Joel M. Skousen, at 801-224-4746. Well, we're about out of time again. You know, you run out of time when you're having fun, so let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet, and if you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.